From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with David Kuo about his controversial new book, Tempting Faith. He says he's witnessed the Bush administration use religion and compassion as political tools to win votes. And he's seen evangelical leaders, seduced by power, willingly put politics before Jesus. Kuo is a conservative evangelical Christian who was deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives from 2001 to 2003. We'll also hear from one of Kuo's critics, Jim Toohey, who is also his former boss at the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university with bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees online. Classes start October 2nd at capella.edu. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, available in stores and online at bn.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest David Kuo is the author of the controversial new book Tempting Faith, in which he charges that the Bush administration manipulated Christian conservatives to get the Christian vote. And he describes ways in which he thinks Christian conservative leaders were seduced by power and acted as if Jesus' main goal was advancing a particular policy agenda. Kuo is himself a conservative evangelical Christian. From 2001 to 2003, he served as the deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. Before that, he was a policy director for then-Senator John Ashcroft and also did work for Ralph Reed, William Bennett, and Bob Dole. His book has been criticized by some current and former members of the Bush administration, as well as several evangelical leaders. A little later, we'll hear from one of his critics, his former boss at the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. Kuo told me that when he joined the office, he hoped it would be impassioned in its work on behalf of the poor. David Kuo, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you think that the office was used as a way to energize the evangelical vote. You write, "I wasn't just a Christian trying to serve God in politics. Now I was a Christian in politics, looking for ways to recruit other Christians into politics so that we would have their votes." What's an example of how you think the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives was used to actually recruit Christian votes?
You know, Terry, that's a really important section there, and it strikes at the deepest spiritual part of me and of the book. And that is, you know, I had been a Christian, I'd been in politics, and I had struggled with, you know, the nexus of the two. And, you know, I then found myself in the White House, having come there to fight for the poor, in a position of really recruiting and using evangelical voters, any Christian voters, trying to recruit African-American pastors, trying to use, frankly, the initiative of the poor purely for political ends. Now, part of that was something that I embraced. I wanted to try and figure out the best way to advance the president's agenda because no one else in the White House seemed to particularly care. And I figured, hey, if we can make this initiative politically relevant in the White House, it would give us the political capital to be able to make a change. As with all things, it's a tough sell, and it was ultimately not the right sell in it because it certainly didn't help fulfill the president's promise for $8 billion a year in aid to the poor.
Well, you described that organized or helped to organize a series of meetings in about 20 battleground states between 2002 and 2004. What was the official purpose of these meetings, and how do you think these meetings were actually used?
These were called roundtable events. You know, not exactly the most original name in the world, but the purpose of them was to try and help out embattled Republican incumbent candidates right before the 2002 elections by bringing in and recruiting, you know, evangelical and minority pastors and charity leaders to appear with someone from the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives and with the incumbent candidate to try and make it appear that the Republican candidate was, you know, inclusive, a different kind of Republican, a compassionate conservative. And it didn't work very well. In terms of aid to the poor, it worked apparently fairly well for the candidates because, you know, the overwhelming majority of them won.
So where does the aid to the poor fit in even to that equation?
What you hit on there is the classic political question of trade-offs and, you know, what do you get? How do you compromise? Because, you know, my bet was that we could elect these people and that they would care more about the poor. They would embrace that agenda. But I know I went to one of these events out in Colorado on behalf of a Republican senator named Wayne Allard in Colorado. And I appeared before, it was the largest of them, I think, several hundred people, no more. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people in an old Safeway store. that had been converted into a church. And I went up there and I embraced in front of this diverse community and I said, this is just a man who embraces President Bush's compassionate conservatism. And I remember thinking as I was just saying these words, you know, but he doesn't actually embrace the compassionate conservatism. He actually doesn't necessarily have antipathy for the poor, but he certainly has a huge measure of apathy. And that's, you know, that is this huge question for anyone who gets involved in the political process. I think it's a bigger question for Christians who get involved in the political process, because it's the question of how much do you compromise your own faith? How much do you compromise the reputation, if you will, of your God for political ends?
How much faith-based money was spent on the kind of events that you're describing here in which you mobilized, like, ministers of color to appear with candidates to help them get elected?
Well, the ones I specifically talk about here that you reference were relatively small events and paid for by, you know, mostly by political campaigns. Mm-hmm. The larger things that I talk about in the book are these things called, that we called religious conferences, White House conferences on faith-based and community initiatives. And these were very, very large. We're talking about bringing in 1,500, 2,000 people to provide faith-based charities and pastors with very useful information, I mean, objectively useful information about how they could apply for federal grants and where federal grants were located. So that information was genuinely, objectively good information and something that I'm proud of, because for these small charities that are out there serving the poor, whether secular or faith-based, it was important information. Now, those conferences, which cost probably $350,000 each, were also held in strategically targeted states. They were held in and around battleground states, specifically targeted for the 2004 presidential race. And so, you know, I mean, how political was it? Well, you know, there was one that was held apparently 10 days before the presidential election in, of all places, Miami, Florida.
You write that one of the premises of the faith-based initiative was that government regulations on religious organizations were too restrictive. And you say finding these examples became a huge priority. If President Bush was making the world a better place for faith-based groups, we had to show it was really a bad place to begin with. But in fact, it wasn't that bad at all.
That's exactly right. We worked very hard to come up with examples for discrimination, because obviously the more examples we had, the worse the problem was. And the worse the problem was, the more that we could do, the more that we could, talk about it. And, one particularly contentious issue was this issue of the right of religious organizations to hire and fire based on faith. Now, actually preserved in the Civil Rights Act is this right, and upheld unanimously by the Supreme Court. And that says, you know, if you're a Buddhist organization, you don't have to hire a Scientologist. You know, if you're a Baptist, you don't have to hire a Zoroastrian. And it simply makes sense. You have to be able to preserve the religious character of these organizations. What came into debate, however, was early in 2001, House conservatives wanted to insert new language in the bill about faith-based charities that wouldn't simply allow people to hire and fire based on faith, but on basically how seriously or validly they practiced that faith. So it became not just about faith, but about your lifestyle within that faith. And that, you know, in a lot of ways was just a battle over gay rights.
You said the president would announce faith-based initiatives that he was funding, and it would sound very impressive, but the money would never actually get spent. Give me an example of that.
The money would actually never get even fought for. This was the thing that was the most common thing I saw within the Bush administration on compassion programs. You know, a big, grand announcement was made, you know, in front of a minority audience or with minorities in the background and big banners, of drug treatment or, you know, trying to help youth violence or gangs or prisoners, and just an extraordinary presentation. It all really looked good on television. It looked good everywhere else. It sounded wonderful. The problem was with follow-up. There wasn't any. After the grand announcement, what the White House knew was it didn't have to follow up. The White House understood the media cycle, and it understood that if it made a grand announcement on compassion, it would look good for the evening news, it would look good for cable news, and it wouldn't be up there very long. It would give the impression that compassion was important and the president was committed to compassion. But in terms of following up, you know, how many people follow up on budget numbers? How many people follow up on appropriations? How many people follow up on how much money gets spent? And they knew that that wasn't going to happen. They knew the media cycle was so frenzied and so rushed that no one would follow it.
Another example you give in terms of funding is a gang prevention initiative, and the funding for that was supposed to total $50 million over 3 years. And you say the obvious inference was that the money would be new spending, but it wasn't new spending. The money was taken out of something else. Where was the money coming from?
This is one of the things that really set me over the edge in terms of, you know, my willingness to speak out. This is a grand announcement in the State of the Union. He did this great lead up to a gang violence initiative, talked very beautifully and movingly about it, and announced, was it $50 million or $90 million, whatever it is, over 3 years. And I called in the next day to listen to the conference call to describe it by the people who were with the administration. And by the end, a reporter asked, okay, well, where's the money coming from? Where is it in the budget? Is it new money? Is it this? And they hemmed and they hawed. And finally, one of them said, well, no, it actually comes out of this thing called the Compassion Capital Fund. Well, I just sat there and that was just, it was like one of those cartoon characters where, the anvil drops on his head or smoke comes out of his ears or both. And it was everything personified, because the Compassion Capital Fund itself, which had been this grand promise of $200 million a year, had been pitifully funded. And now they were cannibalizing this pitifully funded program to announce another grand new program. And the president appeared the next day in Pittsburgh with the first lady and spoke movingly about this gang violence initiative. And it was all really a charade. And, years later now, a very small part of that has been funded as well. And, it strikes me that for my own motivations in politics, what I care about, what I think Jesus cares about in politics, the poor, it's a betrayal.
One of the points that you make in your book that has gotten the most attention is you say that national Christian leaders received hugs and smiles in person, and then after they were dismissed behind their backs, they were described as ridiculous, out of control, and just plain goofy. Would you give me an example of what you observed that led you to this conclusion?
Now, it's funny. When I wrote that, it was one of those things that I thought was one of the most obvious and least controversial things, because everybody who's been involved, honestly involved in Republican politics, has seen this over and over and over again. But it was a warning to Christians to say, hey, listen, this image has been foisted upon you that President Bush is the pastor in chief. That's how evangelicals have been primarily appealed to by the White House. And I said, you need to be aware that that isn't the case. That national Christian leaders, who come in and are appealed to and are being seduced by the White House, behind their backs, they're just, the eyes are rolled and, smirky statements are made. And, they're people who are tolerated, not people who are genuinely loved. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote that. Again, I wrote it without thinking that this is going to be some great hoo-ha.
You described something called The Call, which was a regular conference call from the White House, I believe, to update the evangelical community while soliciting their feedback. Would you describe The Call and how it was used?
There is a regular conference call with evangelical leaders, the ones most people have heard about, to try and, quote-unquote, solicit their input and get their advice and make them feel like they were a genuine part of the White House infrastructure. But the reality is the calls were nothing more than ways to placate them and to make them feel good. And I remember reading, Chuck Colson, who back in the early 1970s, before he, came to Jesus and did the whole prison fellowship thing, talked about his own experience working with Christians in the White House. And he said, of all the groups that he'd ever experienced, they were the ones who were easiest to influence. And he wondered why. And he said, most disturbingly, perhaps it is because they are the most easily seduced by power. And that's what this White House believed about Christian conservatives. And that's what The Call was about. And it's interesting because so many times I've seen it reported that this conference call was this really important thing, that it showed how much influence religious conservatives had, when in fact it was the opposite. It was like they were speaking into a microphone that was unplugged on the other end.
So it was just, you're saying it was just to make evangelical leaders feel connected as opposed to really caring what they had to say.
Yes, that's exactly right.
My guest is David Kuo, author of the new book Tempting Faith and former deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. We'll continue our interview and hear from his former boss who disagrees with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. We've been doing a lot of interviews on Fresh Air about religion and politics. Our approach is to solicit many points of view and to give each speaker time to explain his or her position. We don't go for big fights. They're dramatic, they're often good at getting ratings, but they're not necessarily clarifying. We hope that you'll support the kind of forum public radio provides by calling now with a pledge. Thank you. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Kuo, and he's written a new memoir called Tempting Faith, and it's about the period when he was the deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. This is from 2001 to 2003. And he says in his memoir, basically, that the office was used for partisan purposes and that it cared more about politics than it did about actually helping the poor. You know, after September 11th, Jerry Falwell said, "I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who have tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen." So did you think that he was like goofy and out of control and nuts when he said that? I mean, he's a Christian leader. What was your response to him after September 11th?
It's extraordinary. I mean, it's one of the, it was one of the things that was this jaw-dropping moment for me. I'll never forget it. I mean, it was after 9/11. Everybody is working around the clock to put together this National Day of Prayer and Remembrance. And it's this moment where there was, remember, when there was actual goodwill towards everybody. Everyone was getting along. And we were sitting there after having worked all night, distributing tickets for this event at the National Cathedral, and somebody comes in and says, "Have you heard what Falwell said?" And they repeated what you just said. And I remember sitting there going, "No, that's just thinking, no, that's funny. Someone like at The Onion or somewhere else, someone had said that, because certainly no one could actually say that." But they said, no, they assured me, and they pointed me to a website. And as I recount, I called Karl Rove's office and I said, "What do we do with this? Do we let him in? Do we not?" And you know, after a period of waiting, I heard back from his assistant, said, "No, let him in. Just tell him to avoid the cameras."
You know, as a leader of the Faith-Based Initiative, as somebody who was in touch with a lot of the biggest, conservative Christian leaders in the United States, what, if any, responsibility did you feel you had to stand up and say, these things that Jerry Falwell just said, blaming the ACLU, People for the American Way, and gays and lesbians for September 11th, oh, and abortion, blaming that as well. You know, that we want to separate ourselves from that. The rest of us don't believe this. You know, did you feel like you needed to, at the risk of alienating him, stand up and say, we don't believe that. We don't stand for that.
Yeah, Terry, it's a great point. And I had sort of started discussing that moment with people. And I guess I said it to one too many people, because I got a call from Karl Rove's office saying that, you know, Falwell had faxed an angry fax to Karl Rove's office saying that I was spreading lies about him. And Karl called and said I needed to call him and apologize. I said in protest, I said, but he actually said that. And Karl said, no, please just call and make him go away. So I had to call Jerry Falwell and I had to apologize for saying these things. And you know, it was one of the hard things to do. I felt burning inside that I was doing this. I wasn't apologizing for the sake of Jesus, I was apologizing for the sake of politics. And that wasn't a good thing.
You know, President Bush is perceived as somebody who is very serious about his religion and who really, as a born-again Christian, really relates to evangelicals in America and to, you know, evangelical leaders in America, that he's one of them. And there's this connection that they have that they didn't feel with other presidents, not even quite with President Reagan. And yet you're saying that you think the president wasn't really serious about the faith-based initiative, that he used it for political means more than as a way to actually help the poor. So what are your perceptions about how serious the president has been about using his faith in a public way to serve the larger good?
Now, it's something I hope we have a chance to talk about because, you know, far more than being about the faith-based office, I mean, this question about how religion is mutilated is important. And, you know, in earlier chapters, I say President Bush's religious image was the most carefully controlled part of his public image. You know, I go back and recount in Austin, Texas, right before he made his announcement for president in 1999. You know, he gave two sermons at a United Methodist Church the night before and the morning of, and part of the reason, and it was never covered by the mainstream media, if you will, and you know, part of the reason that he did that was it was part of the underground campaign that was being launched for Christian support of him, and it's an extraordinary story about what happened and how it was put together. Because you had a network of evangelical pastors under the radar screen recruiting other evangelical pastors to support him, so that they did so simply by recounting the story of his own conversion to Jesus. What that did was it allowed him to, by and large, not have to talk about the divisive social issues during the 2000 campaign, to be able to talk about compassion, and to be able to present himself as this different kind of Republican. And it's a really important story.
David Kuo will be back in the second half of the show, and we'll hear from his former boss. Kuo's new book is called Tempting Faith. I'm Terry Gross. You're listening to Fresh Air, and this is NPR, National Public Radio. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our interview with David Kuo. His new book, Tempting Faith, is about working at the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, where Kuo says he watched the Bush administration use religion for political goals. We'll also hear from Jim Toohey, Kuo's former boss at the office, who is now one of his critics.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Sense of Paper, a novel of obsessions by Taylor Holden. From BMW, where drivers can customize their new BMWs and their delivery destination. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most. GatesFoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Kuo. From 2001 to 2003, he served as deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. In his new book, Tempting Faith, he says he witnessed the Bush administration use religion for political ends and watched Christian leaders be seduced by power. I asked Kuo what he wished the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives had accomplished.
I think that all of us in the faith-based office would have been better served by fighting harder for this initiative. You know, not being happy just getting the crumbs from the table, but really passionately fighting much harder with the senior staff and with others to get the promises. And, you know, one of the things I want to say here is there's been this perception of being critical at all of the faith-based office. I am not. The people who worked there are extraordinarily hardworking people who care for the poor. You know, we were the little engine that tried, or the little engine that could, you know, get against a White House that said, oh, no, you can't. You know, and so this point is broader than the faith-based office. You know, it's broader than that. It's much more about the White House, about how they deal with people, and about the seduction of Christians in politics.
You're calling for a fast from politics. You think it's time for religious groups now to disconnect from politics so that they are no longer used for political ends and they could remain more purely committed to the principles of their faith and what their faith tells them to do. Why are you calling for this fast?
Well, as I recount, you know, this journey of mine has been a journey of God and politics from the time I was a kid up until now. And one of the things that's most disturbing is the way God has been perceived now. You know, if I say Jesus, I think most people at the end of the radio will think, oh, okay, abortion, homosexuality, the Iraq War, maybe the estate tax. And that's really actually not what Jesus talked about. And, you know, and I think for, you know, the moms and dads out there, the people who give money to Christian advocacy groups, to the RNC, what they want is something really, you know, important. They want to try and make America better. And they've been led to believe that somehow all of that can be achieved through politics. All of it can be achieved particularly through conservative politics. And you fast from something not because it's evil, but because you want to step away and focus on something more spiritual. And I really would love to see a period of time for a couple of years where evangelical voters stopped giving to all of these political groups and started giving to the poor. You know, started giving their time to after-school programs. Started, you know, doing things that Jesus said, like loving your neighbor, and again redirecting that money towards the poor. And I think that it would provide some needed perspective on the political environment.
You know, I should mention here that you started off in your political life as a liberal Democrat. You worked for the Michael Dukakis presidential campaign. You were an intern to Senator Ted Kennedy. And what was the transition point for you from going from liberal Democrat to conservative Christian?
You know, it's something I really hadn't talked about before this book. But in college, I got a woman pregnant. I was 18 years old or so. And we were kids, and all of a sudden we were faced with this, and we decided to have an abortion, and you know, it was a it was a hard thing to go through. I never thought much about abortion. Neither of us had lived through it, but neither one of us really wanted to be parents, and it seemed like this was the way to go. And so, you know, we went and we had an abortion, and we were assured that, you know, this is really not that big a deal. But afterwards, it was befuddling and confusing, and I didn't know what to make of it. You know, was it this crime against my faith? Was it, as some people were saying at the time, you know, a murder? And was I a murderer? And, you know, and I tried to deal with that. And one of the ways I did was try and look at facts and to say, okay, what happens in a child's, in a fetus's development? And that's the thing that ultimately drove me by accident to the Republicans, because, you know, I ended up sort of incorporating abortion into, you know, a philosophy at the time that said, I am against the death penalty. I am in favor of supporting the poor. And I'm pro-life. So I sort of tried to take a position that said, in all choices, I want to choose life. But when I came to Washington at the time in 1990, I expected, okay, I'd continue to be a Democrat. And I'd work for, you know, a Democrat who was against the death penalty, and, you know, and so on and so forth. But I went there, and no Democrats would hire me. And then I went to try and find Republicans, and they looked at my resume and said, "Oh my goodness, you know, you're clearly a wacko liberal," and they wouldn't hire me. And so I actually ended up working for a year for the National Right to Life Committee, which is the pro-life group out there. And that was my entree into this world of Republican and Christian conservative politics. It was a world that I definitely entered by accident.
Your new memoir begins with you getting diagnosed with a brain tumor. And this was a couple of years ago. And they did the surgery. They got out what they could. But the doctor told you it's likely that at some point this is going to grow back. And it was cancerous. So they told you at some point it would likely grow back. It might be soon. It might be much, much later in life. You don't know. So how directly did that affect your decision to come out, so to speak, and share with the public your reservations about the Bush administration and your concerns about how the faith-based initiative office was used?
Directly. You know, I think I have a very acute understanding of what we all know, and that is life is short, and trying to put things off too long can sometimes really not be a very good idea. And I suppose I've just become a little less tolerant. And by that I mean I've become a little less tolerant of people saying one thing and doing another, particularly when it comes to matters of faith, particularly when it comes to matters of serving the poor, because I'm now much more concerned about the spiritual than I am the political. And I'd much rather stand up and say, hey, you know what, let's focus more on the spiritual, less on the political, because the political really is butchering the faith that I care so much about.
What kind of response are you getting from the White House, from conservatives, and from friends of yours who you've worked with over the years on faith-based initiatives?
The White House has been trotting out a couple of people who used to work there to sort of be the anti-David people. And I'm getting calls from you know, journalist friends who say, you know, the long knives are out for you and be careful. And but you know, this stuff isn't, you know, it hurts. But it's not surprising. You know, there are some friends who are being deeply supportive and who said, this is just fantastic. Keep doing it. You know, there are others who think, who act as if I have committed, you know, not a political act, but an act of heresy, and that I am a blasphemer now, somehow equating President Bush with God, something that I think is untrue. And we'll see what happens. But this is something in which I believe so passionately that it's worth doing. It's worth having this discussion. And you know, I know that a lot of people on the conservative side are saying, oh, well, he's trying to undermine the election, and this is a grand conspiracy to release a book 3 weeks before the election. And to that I say two things. One, I have great concerns for American democracy if I'm going to influence an election. And the second is that, you know, I'm glad the book was released now, because this is a time when people are paying attention to these matters. And you know, if I stand up and say this now, I hope people will listen. I hope people will read. And more than anything, I hope people will think, and that a conversation gets started.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Terry.
David Kuo is the former deputy director of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, and he's the author of the new book, Tempting Faith. One of the people who disagrees with his conclusions is Jim Toohey, his former boss at the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. We'll talk with Toohey after a break. This is Fresh Air. Earlier in our show, David Kuo described how he witnessed the Bush administration use religion for political ends. Kuo's former boss at the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives says that Kuo has it wrong. Jim Tuohy directed the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives from 2002 until May of this year. This month, Tuohy was inaugurated as the president of St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania. Jim Tuohy, welcome to Fresh Air. David Kuo says that, you know, the president would announce faith-based initiatives that would sound very impressive and sound like he was going to fund them with a lot of money, but the money often would not materialize.
Well, the president, I think, pushed whenever he could push. When you look at his record, he kept every promise he made on the faith-based initiative, beginning with his first, which was that he would ask for at least $8 billion his first year in charitable giving incentives and a new funding for programs. And he did, and it took 6 years before we got those charitable giving incentives enacted into law. I mean, he's not king. He has to work with Congress, and there was not as much enthusiasm, perhaps, on the Hill as there was at the White House for the initiative. I also think there's an error when people look at the faith-based initiative and think it's going to be a big spending initiative, and I think that's one of the fundamental misconceptions of what David had in his book, is that somehow the president was going to campaign as a Republican and come be a big spending Democrat. He wasn't. And I say that as a Democrat. I mean, I think it's a healthy debate to talk about whether our country is paying attention to the needs of the poor, and I tend to think that we need to do more. But on the issue of whether the president kept his word and whether he went forward with aggressive initiatives, which now have garnered over $740 million in funds, new programs that didn't exist when he took office, I think it's a very respectable record, and I think he's made steady progress, and he's going to continue on it.
David Kuo mentions The Call, which is a regular conference call, a weekly conference call from the White House to the evangelical community, and the official goal was to solicit the feedback of the community and to keep them updated about what the White House was planning. But Kuo says that the call wasn't really taken seriously by the White House. It was like giving them a microphone that wasn't plugged in. It was just a way to make them feel connected without actually taking seriously what they had to say. What's your reaction?
Well, it's strange to hear that from someone that left the White House praising the president and praising the integrity and honesty of everyone that he worked with. I was on that call once or twice, maybe three times in 4 years. It wasn't a call that I participated in unless I was briefing religious leaders. This was something that was done out of the political side of the White House, keeping organizations and individuals just tuned in to what we do, whether they support us or not. And to try to allege that, in fact, it was just a ruse, that to me is a very cynical take on it. Now, there may have been people in the White House that viewed it that way, and maybe David viewed it that way. And I think, you know, talk to the ministers and look at the record of what the White House accomplished. But I just think that you can't, on the one hand, leave the White House and say that you work with people with great integrity and honesty, and then, on the other hand, come back and say they're doing these kind of cynical things.
One of the things Kuo says in his book that has gotten a lot of attention is that people in the Bush administration, like, hugged religious leaders in person and smiled at them, but then behind their backs would...
They were putting whoopee cushions out.
Well, would call them ridiculous and goofy.
I just, you know, it's completely at odds with everything I saw in 4.5 years. Again, perhaps at the junior level, perhaps with young aides, there was this kind of shenanigan. But what the problem with the book is that it gives the impression this was happening at the high levels of the White House. And I never saw it. The president set the tone. He had great respect for all the different religious leaders of our country. And I saw him in meetings, and then I'd see him before the meeting and after the meeting. And I never saw the slightest bit of being two-faced, which is what the book is alleging. And again, when you don't name names, when you don't identify individuals, it really begs the question, well, who exactly is he talking about? But when you say it was in Karl Rove's office, clearly you're trying to allow the impression that this was somewhere high up in the White House. And I just, again, find that very hard to accept, that kind of accusation of hypocrisy. The reality is, evangelical leadership in this country agreed with President Bush on some things, disagreed on others, and they're not a political party. They have their own issues and agenda, but in terms of their interaction with the White House, there were times when they'd be upset with us and we with them. But there was also some deep mutual respect and, in fact, friendship with guys like Rick Warren and Dr. Dobson and Chuck Colson. These are people I'm proud to call friends.
Let me ask you a question that I also asked David Kuo. Kuo quotes something that Falwell said that has since become very famous. After the attacks of September 11th, Jerry Falwell said that the attacks were because God was angry with pagans, gays, lesbians, abortionists, feminists, the ACLU, and people for the American way. What was your reaction when he said that? You know, as somebody who had a leadership position within the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, as somebody who was working with conservative evangelical leaders like Jerry Falwell, what was your response to that?
Well, that would be an example of where we would be in disagreement. And as I recall, the president put out a statement, or the White House put out a statement to that effect, that we did not share that view at all. I never met with Reverend Falwell the entire time I was there at the White House. So I don't know what others might have said to him personally. But I certainly think that there were times when you'd hear statements and you'd scratch your head and you'd realize that this wasn't a helpful statement if it was about Islam or if it was about issues like this at a time of September 11th. But you also had occasions where we were in complete agreement with some of the statements that our evangelical friends were saying. So this was the kind of thing where there were times when there was disagreement and times of agreement.
What would you offer as one of the greatest accomplishments during your watch under the Faith-Based Initiative and one of your greatest frustrations?
Accomplishments would be that the president has changed the culture and how faith-based organizations are treated in the public square. Hundreds of new groups are getting federal grants. The focus is more on results. And you look at a program like the Access Recovery Program the president started that's received hundreds of millions of dollars, and now addicts actually have choice in where they're treated instead of being, you know, channeled to failing programs that have failed them. The focus is now on recovery. So there were a lot of new programs started, $740 million in new programs. You also saw it take root in the heartland. We have over 30 governors with faith-based offices, including at least a dozen that are Democratic governors. And I went to Democratic governors' states and was with Janet Napolitano in Arizona, and I was with Governor Granholm's faith-based conference, keynoted it there, with Governor Blanco in Louisiana. So we were very even-handed in reaching out. I was proud of that. I was proud that it was upheld in court, no constitutional challenge on it. We were upheld on issues that we felt were important. So those were the proud ones, Terry. I guess in terms of frustration, you would see the politics swirl around the issue, and it got frustrating. And I know that on the charitable giving legislation, it took 6 years before we could get something as simple as a deduction for individuals with individual retirement accounts to be able to give those to charities. That took 6 years to get. So there were times when that got quite frustrating. And then I think one thing that perhaps David and I view differently is that September 11th really did change the landscape. I mean, he can say, well, that wasn't a priority before September 11th or not, but I think that's a little flippant, because the reality is the budget redirected hundreds of billions of dollars. You also had Katrina. You also had the deficit pressures. And so there were a lot of things that really squeezed the discretionary dollar. And so that was frustrating, because there were often new pilot programs that we would like to have had on a larger scale. So I was there for those years. And for people like David that worked in the office before September 11th, they were so accustomed to the buzz and to the light that I don't think they ever adjusted after September 11th to the new landscape.
Why did you leave the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives?
Well, I had a wonderful opportunity to go to St. Vincent College, this little Catholic Benedictine college in the foothills of the Laurel Mountains in Pennsylvania near La Trobe. And so it was a wonderful opportunity. And quite frankly, the president deserves some fresh legs. I had been there for 4 years and 4 months, and I think he deserved the benefit of new energy. Like a lot of people at the White House that were there for most of the first term, it is a grueling pace. I have 5 children, so it was definitely something where I felt I needed a change, and this wonderful opportunity came up, and I'm happily with these 1,700 students at a great, great college.
I know I'm not the only person interviewing you about your response to the David Kuo book, so now that you're in a much quieter academic setting, do you feel you're being drawn back into the Washington maelstrom?
I do a little. I feel like I've come out of retirement, you know. I feel like Roger Clemens or something coming in late. But the reality is some of the charges really went to the heart of the integrity of what we did. And they allowed so many different false impressions of what took place that I just felt in good conscience I couldn't sit back and say nothing, because I was really proud of what we accomplished with the Faith-Based Initiative. I felt we made real progress and we kept the priority on the poor. And in this political minefield, we were even-handed. And at the end of the day, at the end of my term, I had been in more Democratic districts than Republican ones. And I had met with more public officials that were Democrats than Republican ones. So I think when you look at the unique character of what we actually accomplished, it was very hard for us to take a book coming out by someone that had worked within the White House and had left very happily and saying wonderful things, then coming out in a couple weeks before election and slamming the president. It just didn't seem right.
Jim Toohey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great being on with you, Terry.
Jim Toohey is the former director of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives and is the new president of St. Vincent College in Pennsylvania. Earlier, David Kuo described how he thinks the Bush administration has used religion and the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives for political ends. This is Fresh Air. The country may be politically and culturally divided, but we should all be able to talk with each other. Listening to different points of view is one of our goals on Fresh Air. We hope you'll support the forum that public radio provides by calling with a pledge. Thank you. Daniel Mendelsohn is an acclaimed literary critic and the author of a memoir called The Elusive Embrace. His new work of nonfiction is called The Lost. It's about his 5-year search for information about 6 of his family members who died in the Holocaust. The Lost is part detective story, part travelogue, part scholarly meditation, part family memoir. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that although The Lost may be hard to categorize, it's completely engrossing.
If you didn't have an amazing story, you didn't survive. That's what one Holocaust survivor dismissively tells Daniel Mendelsohn. She's warning Mendelsohn, her interviewer and much younger friend, against sentimentality. But she's also illuminating an essential problem with Holocaust testimony. Yes, these stories of the survivors are amazing. That's why the tellers live to tell their tales. But we contemporary listeners and readers now expect to be awed by Holocaust stories, and consequently we've become somewhat jaded to the horrors, the heart-rending acts of courage, the twists of fate that mark these accounts. How do you write a true story about the Holocaust and lead your readers through it so that they're feeling and thinking anew? That's the challenge that Mendelsohn rises to in his epic book, The Lost. Through meticulous, even obsessive, scholarship and detective work, Mendelsohn unearths and reconstructs the lives of 6 people in his own family who died in the Holocaust. As Mendelsohn makes us readers realize, the survivors aren't the only ones with amazing stories. Many of those who perished also had amazing stories they didn't get the chance to tell. The Lost is a big, frantic book. Its intertwined stories race over decades and continents. Mendelsohn tracks down fast-disappearing friends and neighbors of his murdered family members in Sweden, Israel, Australia, and the little town called Bolokov, claimed for part of the 20th century by Austria, then Poland, then others, where his mother's family came from. Mendelsohn's story is rooted, however, in the mundane, in the sights and sounds of jokes with Yiddish punchlines, Milton Berle on black and white TV sets, and packets of Tums. In other words, it's rooted in the visits he, his parents, and siblings would pay to elderly relatives living in Miami Beach during the 1960s. Here's the first sentence of Mendelsohn's book, which describes those visits. Some time ago, when I was 6 or 7 or 8 years old, it would occasionally happen that I'd walk into a room and certain people would begin to cry. The old people cried, Mendelsohn learned, because he looked so much like his Grandpa Abe's oldest brother, Shmuel, who along with his wife and 4 daughters were killed in the Holocaust. When Grandpa Abe dies, the then 20-year-old Mendelssohn discovers letters folded away in Abe's wallet. Letters written in 1939 from Schmiel, begging his brother to find a way to get him and his family out of Poland. Those letters, the memory of those weepy Miami Beach gatherings, his grandfather's mesmerizing tales of Bulgakov, and the quirks of Mendelssohn's own scholarly personality turn him into the fierce family archaeologist, intent on rescuing what artifacts, what stories may be left about Schmiel and his family. That summary does as much justice to The Lost as, say, describing Homer's Odyssey as a story about a boat trip with detours. The Odyssey, by the way, is referenced in The Lost, as are Virgil's Aeneid and the Old Testament. Even though the individual fates of Schmiel and his family are Mendelssohn's specific focus here, he calls upon his scholarly background to make unpretentious and enlightening parallels between, say, the murderous hatred directed toward the Jews before and during World War II by their once brotherly Ukrainian and Polish neighbors in Bulgakov, and the biblical story of Cain and Abel, also a tale about fratricidal resentments that become murderous. But the most stunning aspect of Mendelssohn's book is his vexed commitment to, as he says, learn whatever scraps of details about Schmiel and his family might be knowable. Mendelssohn, as I've said, is an intellectual. He's hip to the fact that the word fact oftentimes needs to be put in quotation marks. But The Lost is informed by Mendelssohn's anxious sense of obligation to his murdered relatives, an obligation not to just turn them into puppets to be manipulated for the purposes of a good story, even though he also knows that inevitably this manipulation will sometimes happen in the course of his compelling narrative. Mendelssohn's dedication to ferreting out the truth, however imperfect, is rewarded by the end of The Lost. Implicitly paying tribute to his grandpa Abe, the master storyteller, whose sweeping tales would unify and narrow into a breathtaking finish, Mendelssohn ends his story by finding the place he's been looking for decades, a narrow hole in the ground, a box-like hiding place, an ark of sorts that for a brief time sheltered members of his family from annihilation.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Lost by Daniel Mendelssohn. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with British journalist Stephen Gray about his new book, Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. The book is about the secret rendition program that has sent detainees suspected of terrorism to other countries where they are imprisoned and sometimes tortured. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.